Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, everyone. This is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, I am lucky to have Gary Nissenbaum on the show from GDNLaw.com. Gary is a managing attorney and the principal of the Nissenbaum Law Group, and he's an internet law attorney. We have a lot of programmers on the show, but I haven't had a lot of people to come on and really explain how things work from a legal perspective. So I'm very happy to have Gary on the show. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you, and thank you for having me. I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, we are all developers who listen, or we are IT people, or we are maybe advanced users. And even though I consider myself an advanced user, you know, I tend to just click I agree on the website terms and conditions, and I'm starting to worry that maybe I need to read it like completely.
Well, everybody keeps telling you to be more agreeable in life. This is one of those situations where it might not make sense to do that without looking at it a little closer. So we'll talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, what are the rights that are affected? And between a website terms and conditions or when I hit OK on my iPhone with every app that I install?
Well, what people automatically assume, I think, is that the terms and conditions are about payment. They're about utilizing your credit card. They're about being able to gather information about you. But there are other very important rights that are being scaled back to one extent or another that you have. They're important. So when you click those terms and conditions, generally speaking, you may be waiving your right to sue. You're waiving the liability for utilizing the website. It may be that you are making a representation that you're not infringing on anyone. So if you are infringing, and the website gets sued for some reason, you may be indemnifying the people who own the website. You may be consenting to jurisdiction or a choice of law in a state that. In which you don't reside and you have no other connection to. So these sorts of things are rights that are being either waived completely or at least changed in some fashion that you may not be immediately thinking of when you click in. The one we're going to talk about today, which is one of the really important ones, is waiving your right to sue in a court of law or to file a class action. Be part of a class action, and instead relegating you to an arbitration.
What is the difference between an arbitration and suing? I mean, ultimately, I want someone to hear my problem, and I want them to hear me, and either they win or I win.
Well, that's another really interesting part of this, is that people generally think that arbitration is a wonderful development because you don't have to go through the crowded courts. You're not dealing with the lengthy delays. You're not dealing with a judge who may know nothing whatsoever about the digital world. And you have far more control about scheduling and other things. But few people who aren't in this world, the world of law and the world of dispute resolution, are aware or think of the fact that you're waiving your right to a jury trial. You're almost getting rid of your right to an appeal. You can appeal, but the appellate rights are very, very difficult to assert. Usually it's whether what was done by the arbitrator was arbitrary and capricious. You're scaling back the tools you have to subpoena witnesses and get discovery. You can do it, but it's not the same robust discovery of facts and documents that you would have in a lawsuit. And I guess this is an important point to make as well, which is I'm speaking in generalities because I don't know the state in which your listeners are listening to this. I certainly don't know when they're going to be listening to this. These are all evolving areas of the law. So nothing I'm giving you should be relied on as legal advice. But on the other hand, I'm trying to give you general principles that I think are applicable to most situations on some level.
That's a great point. As we like to say on the internet, I-A-N-A-L, I am not a lawyer. And while I am not a lawyer, and while you are, sir, neither of us are giving any kind of advice that someone should take action on. Just like when I talk about open source licensing, I speak in generalities from my opinion. The same thing applies. You may be listening to this show tomorrow or 5 years from now. Things change, but the general structure that you're outlining here will at least give the listeners an opportunity to go and research this on their own.
That's right. It's not hard to find this stuff on the internet. If you just want to look at some of the cases that I'm talking about and the reference materials, they're easily accessible.
Mm-hmm. So I'm hearing a little bit that going into arbitration is a bit of a dice roll, more so than having a formal lawsuit, because like you use the word capricious, like you just don't know who the arbitrator is, if they've received appropriate discovery, if all of the things that you need to make your case to the arbitrator have been made available to them.
One of the great things about arbitrations, let's talk about it, the upside, is that you could pick somebody who's, for example, the former general counsel of a major IT company, and have that person be your arbitrator. They'll know the lingo, they'll understand the concepts, they will have managed these kinds of projects, and so whatever the dispute is, if it's that hyper-technical, they're already there. They don't have to be educated on the basic information. They just have to learn about the case. So that's an example where it works really well. But the downside, and you do have some volitional control over who the arbitrator will be. You get to pick from a list. You know, usually it's done consensually. There are times when the arbitrator's name is thrust upon you, but that's a rare situation. But the more important thing is that you don't have the levels of protection, the structure of the court system. And as you know from the world of being a developer and being in the digital world, when you take shortcuts through a complicated system to achieve a goal, sometimes it works, sometimes it's a disaster. And so it's as you said, you're taking more of a chance in arbitration because there's less structure.
Mm-hmm. It's a little surprising to me that there isn't some kind of a requirement. Like, I don't know how it works in medical arbitration or medical cases, but you would assume that you'd want maybe, I don't know, an arbitrator who was also a doctor or had some expertise. But it seems like in all of these areas, there's no requirement that the arbitrator be IT experienced or a developer themselves. They could just be anyone.
Well, actually, you're describing the court system. When you think about it, there's no requirement that a judge know anything about your particular industry. And in fact, you don't get to choose your judge. So if anything, this is more in that direction where the two parties are splitting the cost most of the time of the arbitrator. They're deciding which organization to use to supply the arbitrator and which rules to use. So you do have some control over that. And assuming both parties want someone who has industry experience, the likelihood is that you'll get somebody with at least some industry experience.
Interesting. And it is a thumb war as they go back and forth. And if you did go to a lawsuit and there was a jury involved or those people are either pro or con, and they're during discovery, they're trying to figure out whether or not, not discovery, rather during jury selection, they're trying to figure out whether the person is going to be beneficial towards one side or the other, right?
That's right. There's a whole career path for people who evaluate juries they're called jury consultants, and they help lawyers pick juries. It's never clear who you're going to get on that jury and what their predispositions are. You get the chance to ask them questions, but frankly, how many questions can you ask, and how much can you learn about somebody in that quick situation where you're just asking a few questions in a public forum? So in a situation where there's no jury, the result you might get might be more predictable. However, The other side of that is you may have a lawsuit in which you are a sympathetic plaintiff. In other words, you're an employee suing an employer, and there's a lot more people on that jury who are employees than are employers. There might be somebody who is injured, and so there's a sympathy factor. So the idea is there are certain lawsuits, certain disputes in which juries are very, very beneficial for one side and are a real problem for the other side because of likability.
Interesting. So that actually brings me to the larger question of why businesses want terms and conditions that prevent lawsuits. Why do they want to push us, the users, towards this arbitration? Are they doing that because arbitration is fundamentally pro-business or better for the businesses?
Some people say that. I think it's more nuanced than that. I think that generally businesses want predictability. And that predictability means that the subset of information and education that one person has is the same as the general subset as the other people in the process. The person who started this business, is running this business, is the representative of this business, may have a similar orientation toward business that the arbitrator has, which doesn't mean they're going to win. It doesn't mean the arbitrator is going to always decide in favor of the business. But what it does mean is that we're talking about apples and apples. We have similar assumptions, and we're not going to necessarily, who knows, but we're not going to necessarily have these outlier decisions, these decisions that don't seem to have a rational basis or that seem unpredictable. And don't forget what I said originally, which is that the appeal process, generally speaking, is you can appeal on the basis that the award was arbitrary and capricious. Now, those two words are pretty extreme. I mean, it's very hard to show that something that somebody did was totally arbitrary and completely capricious. That's unusual. So again, the idea is that you're putting yourself in someone's hands. You want to know that their orientation toward the dispute, up or down, whether you win or lose, is of a similar nature.
How could the law enforce these terms and conditions if I just, I don't know, bumped agree, or I didn't speak English and I clicked agree? Did they put in a database somewhere, he clicked agree on this date from this location at this IP address at this latitude and longitude? Or do they just say, well, he made it this far, he must have clicked agree? How is it binding at all? I didn't sign anything.
What's so interesting about this is that it goes back to, believe it or not, 1925.
Doesn't it all?
Yeah, that seems to be. So 1925, there was a law that was passed. It was called the Federal Arbitration Act. And essentially what this said was that the United States wants to promote capitalism. And in order to do that, it wants disputes to be resolved rapidly, fairly, with people with some level of expertise. And so it gave authority to two arbitrations, that arbitrations had jurisdiction, arbitrations were binding. However, for purposes of what we're discussing today, there was a countervailing concept in the same law, which said that in a contract, you could waive your right to a lawsuit and force an arbitration. So it wouldn't be a decision that you would make consensually, the way I was just saying, the way the law was meant to be. You could literally force somebody into arbitration if you could show that they waived their right to go to court and that they affirmatively agreed to go into arbitration. And in fact, the courts use the term, there's a liberal federal policy favoring arbitration agreements. So the very agreements I'm talking about are favored by the courts. The courts want us to arbitrate if we can.
Hmm. How is it enforceable, though? How, from an app developer's perspective, I talk to a lawyer, I get some paperwork, I put the paper, you know, I paste it into my dialog box, I put agree and disagree. Couldn't I just argue I never pushed agree?
Well, there was a case that was recently decided concerning Uber's terms and conditions and the placement of the clickable link and so forth. There was another case that was recently decided with Amazon's, and another one that was recently decided with Airbnb. And this group of cases really illustrates the trend of what we're talking about. But to go to your question in particular, there was an interesting analogy in the Amazon case. These are all federal cases. In the Amazon case, the court said that it's like a basket of apples being sold, and there's a wall behind it filled with signs. Some of those signs contain information necessary for the purchase, such as price, method of payment, delivery details, and so forth. Others you disregard because they're advertisements. And among all those different signs, there's additional terms and conditions, possibly waiving the right to go to court. The question is, has the Apple stand owner provided reasonably conspicuous notice that you're waiving your rights? And we're going to talk today about the fact that it's a 51%, 49% decision, and there's a lot of factors as to whether these terms and conditions are in fact enforceable, whether you can force somebody to waive their right to go to court. And what's interesting about that for developers is that it resides not so much in the law, not so much in these ancient concepts of contract. That's only where it starts. But where the decision really resides is in how you configure the website, the graphical interface, where things are, how they're clickable. And that is why I'm on the air with you today, because it's really more of a developer's expertise that you need to make your way through this thicket than as well as legal ability and a legal understanding of what a contract is about.
Interesting. I would probably guess or argue that most developers don't give it much thought. There is a thing in the developer community, though, that is called dark user interface concepts, where one goes out of their way to obscure things. Like, I'm sure you've gone to download a file before or download some application, and you clicked on the button that looked like it was download, but it was really an advertisement that had a download button embedded. These are those dark user interface styles where someone has maliciously coded something or written something and counted on, you know, non-technical parent to go and click on something like that. I would presume if I want to have an enforceable terms of service, I would want to go out of my way to make it the opposite of that, to make it very obvious so there's no question that this is clear and obvious and that the user has the opportunity to understand those terms and conditions.
That's right. The example you gave is the easy one, because if you're clicking something that you think is one thing and it's deliberately meant to mislead, mm-hmm. it's very likely that won't be enforceable. But in this world, there are really four terms. And if we have a takeaway today from this podcast, these are the four terms we have to talk about, which is a click wrap, a browse wrap, a scroll wrap, and a sign-in wrap. And the reason they keep saying the word wrap is that it goes back to what used to be called shrink wrap, when they would put plastic around something and then you would open it up. And when you opened it up, the terms and conditions would be right there in the shrink wrap. So the idea is click wrap is when a person goes on a website and the user has to click I agree in a certain box after being presented with the terms and conditions. That is a strong and robust website disclaimer, and terms and conditions are generally enforceable. Browse wrap is where you post the terms and conditions via a hyperlink at the bottom of the screen, but you're not required to expressly click them. You're not required to expressly consent to them. There isn't an actual link that forces you to say, I agree or don't agree. Scroll wrap is where you have to scroll through the terms you have to indicate your assent to them by clicking I agree. Again, strong, because they did look through them. And then the final one is a sign-in wrap, where you're notified of the existence of the terms and conditions, but instead of providing an I agree button, you're basically advised at a later point in the sign-in process or the purchase process that you are, by purchasing this item, agreeing to the terms and conditions as well. It's not a separate button for terms and conditions.
Right.
Those are four different things, and they have four different levels of enforceability.
It's interesting that I would think that I couldn't tell you the year that it happened, but I remembered when I saw a scroll wrap for the first time, and I was like, oh, okay, I guess I'm going to hold page down and then actively not read this, and then hit, you know, then the agree button will light up when I get to the bottom. I suppose I would have some amount of plausible deniability, but it's such a much more significant action to actively scroll past the terms of services and then click agree. Certainly hard to prove that I didn't do that, or that I, you know, other than having apathy towards it.
And just to show you how close a call all this is, the main case that just came out, there was a case decided in August of 2017. That's how recent it is. The lower court, the Federal District Court for the Southern District of New York, decided that the Uber terms and conditions were not enforceable. And the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the appellate court that heard the appeal of that same case, so it went up on appeal, it overturned that and said that under these facts, it was enforceable. So you have two different courts, very well respected, coming to different conclusions with the same facts. And if you want, I can go into some of the sort of characteristics of the Uber situation, and maybe this might be interesting to your listeners to kind of hear how that was parsed.
Yes, please do.
In the Uber case, it was a man named Kalanick, K-A-L-A-N-I-C-K. This is a 2015 case. And basically, riders of Uber they had a first screen, they click next, go to the second screen. The second screen has a registration process and various fields for credit cards and so forth. And beneath the field is a large prominent button that says register. Beneath that button, in very, very small font, are the words, quote, by creating an Uber account, you agree to the terms of service and privacy policy. And so that is in there, but it's not highlighted in a way that would make the person kind of see it in all the clutter of the screen. A potential user, here's the key, may click on the register button without clicking on the terms of service button. So you don't have to hit terms of service in order to finish the transaction. You're just advised about it. There was a point in the case about the fact that the letters were small, that you're looking at this on a cell phone, so it's way small. And that even if you did click the hyperlink for the terms of service, you're not taken to the actual terms and conditions. You're taken to a screen that contains a button that then you have to click again to get to the terms of service. And it's only by clicking that you get there. So my point is that this was a situation in which you were going over and over and over this, one screen after another screen after another screen, to finally get to the terms of service. And the court basically said that there was a problem with this. You cannot assume, and here's the key, that a reasonable smartphone user, a person who is a reasonably prudent smartphone user, is aware of the likely contents of the terms of service under these conditions. And it is requiring a breadth of the range of technological savvy of online purchasers that may not exist here. And so that's really the key to the lower court saying this cannot fly, the person is not agreeing to it. What was interesting is that the Court of Appeals, when it went on appeal, the Second Circuit disagreed. And they said that this was reasonably conspicuous given and this is a quote, that modern cell phones are now such a pervasive and insistent part of daily life that the proverbial visitor from Mars might conclude they were an important feature of human anatomy. Two-thirds of American adults own a smartphone. And that the idea of even going on Uber means that you have been able to download an app. You can't do it without downloading the Uber app. So the very fact that you've gotten here to the point of using the app means you've downloaded it, which means that you understand the process of downloading an app and that you've already seen that there's a terms and conditions that accord with that app. And you also understand that text that is highlighted in blue and underlined means that it's a hyperlink and that you can click on it and that there's another screen you're going to go to. And so putting all that together, the court said, yeah, perhaps in 1995 or 2005 even, we might have decided this differently. But now, with the fact that this is just the way life is and people use these apps as part of their daily life, that there is a heightened standard of technological savvy that we're going to accord to reasonably prudent people. Therefore, we're going to assume that they understood what they were doing.
Yeah, that is a tough one. I mean, I never underestimate, though, the ignorance of the human condition. I honestly could totally understand both ways, and that's why it's so interesting that this was then ruled and then overturned. Certainly, do all people? I always use the term non-technical parent. Does non-technical parent know that there's a terms and conditions? Honestly, unless they had a scroll wrap or something that blocked them, I would probably argue that my parents would not know that there were terms buried in the terms and conditions that would in any way hurt them.
But Scott, here's the interesting thing about that. The courts talk about that, and they discuss the fact that there is a level of willful ignorance that that if the law only requires that you make a reasonable effort to make this conspicuous and to give your user a reasonable opportunity to utilize this, that you're not tricking anybody and you're not making it so complicated that it just the right has no value. But if you have somebody who uses an app and understands there are terms of service, understands that they are probably agreeing to them because that's why they're there, but has refused to read them, neglected to read them, the court has very little sympathy for that person. You had your chance. You didn't read them. Well, okay, they're enforceable, and you kind of know that, and you're taking your chances. So it's an interesting dynamic because there's two sides to it. And by the way, there were two other cases in the last 2 years, one for Amazon and one for Airbnb, that went two different ways on this, which, if you want, I can talk a little bit about that. Do we have time to just...
Sure, we've got a few minutes. Before you start that, for people who want to learn more about the Uber case, just to make sure the names are clear, Travis Kalanick was the former chief executive officer, former CEO, stepped down. The individual on the other side there was Mayer, M-E-Y-E-R. So if you look for Spencer Mayer and Kalanick, you can learn about that. And it's playing out in the news. This just happened in August, the overturning in the second Court of Appeals.
That's right. And remember, if you are looking at this online, there were two different cases. There's the Southern District of New York case. That's the lower court. It was overturned by the Second Circuit. So you got to see both to really get the full picture. Let me just briefly talk about two other cases that your listeners might find interesting along these lines. Selden, S-E-L-D-E-N versus Airbnb. This is a 2016 case, and this is in the D.C. Circuit, meaning Washington, D.C. And this was basically a situation in which an African-American wanted to get a residence on Airbnb in order to go on vacation or whatever. He was turned down. He, as the court said, smelled a rat. So he went in and made it appear that he was Caucasian. And immediately the answer was, yes, it's available. You can have this. And so he sued for racial discrimination. And the question was, do you have to go to arbitration under the terms and conditions? And what the court there found was that arbitration was required, that the terms and conditions would be enforced. And here's... Again, we're going to get into the detail here because this is what your listeners need to know when they're creating websites and applications and so forth. By signing up, I agree to Airbnb's terms of service. That wording is very conspicuous. It's in the middle of the page next to the sign-up button, dark font, legible, appropriately sized. And so the concept is an active adult consumer would appreciate that by signing up for the service, they agree to the terms and conditions. Now, turning to the other case, which is Amazon, this was a case in the Second Circuit. Again, this is in that court of appeals that encompasses New York and certain other states in that area. That one, they said that Amazon's terms and conditions might not be enforceable. They said that this had to go back and there had to be a hearing, there had to be a trial on this. And this was a hybrid between a click wrap and a browse wrap. And what they said was an Amazon, and this will be familiar to people who use Amazon, an Amazon purchaser was not required to click I agree after being presented with a list of terms and conditions, nor was the purchaser simply left to browse the page, but you were asked to click place your order after being told elsewhere that by placing your order, you agree to the privacy notice and conditions of use. So the point is, you're not clicking the terms of use. You're clicking a button that says, by clicking this button, you're agreeing to the terms of use.
And I see. So you take an explicit action to continue your relationship, your transactional relationship with Amazon, and implicitly you are agreeing to their privacy notice and their conditions of use.
That's right. And so what they're saying is, first of all, that might be confusing to people. First of all, they might overlook it. And the second part of that was that the words, by placing your order, you agree to Amazon's conditions of use, was not bold. It wasn't capitalized. It wasn't conspicuous in terms of what else was on the web page. There was a lot of information on the web page. And so the idea was that because there were so many links, there were so many things, they were saying that I think there were 15 to 25 links on the order page, alongside buttons for promotion and advertisements and so forth, that it was just, as they said, distracting, so as to temper whatever effect the notification had, such that the person might not know that they were giving up these rights. So again, the point is not to say that there's something wrong with Amazon and something right with Airbnb or anything like that. The point here is to say that this is something that developers should be looking at carefully. You don't want to just assume that because you've always done it this way, this is the way it should be done, because you're using a template that a customer or client is using, that's correct. Instead, the actual configuration of the pages, the click-throughs, the I agrees, the so forth, all of that should be looked at by an attorney who's familiar with this, as well as the actual terms of and conditions. Those should be reviewed so that it comports with this case law, especially because the case law is changing so rapidly.
Yeah. There are articles written online that the browse wrap and click wrap distinction is kind of falling apart. Do I need to, as a developer, I mean, do I need to ask them a quiz? You know, like, hey, referring back to paragraph 6, what's the fifth word? Like, how far do I have to go as a developer?
Well, that's what we do. In other words, you're describing what we do. We have clients. We have a lot of e-commerce clients. We have a lot of people who want us to review their websites for efficacy and enforceability. And we literally go through each page. We look at it. We look at the factors in the cases, and we make recommendations. And by the way, these recommendations, a lot of them are common sense recommendations. And it may be that when someone is putting one of these websites together, the developer is being given conflicting signals, because the developer is sort of in between. The customer, their client, is telling them, you know, I want functionality. I want it to be quick. I want to be able to sell the service, et cetera. And then they have to also be saying, well, if it's too quick and it's too simple, you may not have enforceability. So the lawyer in the mix may be saying, well, we need these changes to, it might slow it down a little bit. There might be an extra screen. There might be an extra click that has to happen. But that's important, because if you sell the product with no terms and conditions, if you're selling the service with no terms and conditions, you're putting the client in danger without them even knowing it.
This is really, really useful information, and I appreciate you taking the time to chat with me about it today. So you can check out Gary's website at gdnlaw.com. Not only do they do internet law, but also if you're an app developer or maybe you're doing video games, they have a separate section on app and video game developer legal services. A lot of experience in this space, gdnlaw.com. Thank you so much, Gary, for chatting with me.
Thank you, and thank you to all your listeners for listening, and good luck. I hope that this process is a little bit easier having listened to this podcast.
Fantastic. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.